Okay, so I guess we just talked about the assignment. So I know it was due, and I just remembered today about it that I could have posted it earlier, I suppose, last Friday. But I mean, or you could have gone to the last year's assignments. It's essentially the same thing. I changed it a little bit compared to last year. So I guess it's about calculating the profile of a new white dwarf. Last year it was a hydrogen white dwarf. Today, this year is a helium white dwarf. So there's some difference. Anyway, so I mean, I guess the deadline isn't hard deadline. So you could do it in a few days after the deadline. Let's see what else. I'll be away for 2 weeks next week. Avery would give one lecture, and then that should put us back on track because I mean, we are having lectures on Fridays as well. It's on Fridays. So that's something to have in mind. Of course, I mean, I'll be meeting you a couple of times before. We'll be doing our first tutorial on Friday. So we're going to discuss your solutions to assignment one. And the way it's going to work is you're going to present. I guess one of you will volunteer, or some of you will volunteer to present your solutions, and then we discuss that. Let's see if there's anything else. That's it. So we're making our way through. Is there any questions about logistics or about stuff we discussed last time? So one thing I realized when I was discussing this opacity. Remember we discussed opacity of Thomson scattering, which was something, I don't know, it's about a 0.4 square centimeter per gram. And then the free opacity, I was a bit puzzled why it was turns out to be bigger. No, but it was just because of the units. Opacity of free, it's 10 to the 23, or 20, I guess 4 times. Let me just put it 4 times 10 to the 22. Centimeter squared per gram. I mean, there are some coefficients that I'm not going to write of order 1. I guess there's 1 plus x. It has to do with how much electrons there are. You remember we discussed this. And then there's x plus y. It has to do with density. And then this was rho in CGS units, gram square centimeter to the power. And then T divided by Kelvin, power of minus 7/2, I guess. So the point is, this looks big, except that, I mean, this is a very big density, right? So if typical density in interstellar medium, let's say, it's one particle per square centimeter. So that would be like 10 to the minus 24 times this, right? So that's already becomes smaller or comparable than this. And then, of course, temperatures could be much significantly bigger, like say in a star. And if the temperature is big, then that brings this down by more orders of magnitude. So then usually this free. So the typical situation is the free is much less efficient than Thomson scattering. And what is special about free is it can change the number of photons. Remember, so we discussed this thing doesn't change the number of photons. So if you want to get rid of the chemical potential, you need this to be important. As it turns out in early universe, for example, and the other important thing, it depends on density because it involves collisions of two particles rather than. So the photon for free absorption, the photon interacts not with one ion or not with one electron, but with one ion and one electron. So it depends on the density, capacity. So in high density regions like in early universe, this can become important, but it turns out that like you have to go to very high densities. For this to be significant compared to Thomson scattering. So like at temperature of 0.1 electron volt, universe becomes optically thick. to Thomson scattering, but you have to go to temperature of a keV or so for Bremer-Stahlung to become important. You have to go to higher densities for this to be important. But then depending on situation, depends on how rho and T changes in situation, different situations, then these ratios could be different. So in early universe, as I said, that's how it works. Okay. Any questions? So that was, yeah, that was the only thing I think it was, I got confused about it at the end of the lecture. Let's see, what else do we have? Right. Dynamics, gravitational dynamics. Okay. So today we're going to do more radiative processes. So I guess the same more radiative processes. So I'm going to talk about, So I'm going to talk about mostly synchrotron radiation. Let's see what else. And the spectral lines, basically. These are the two topics I was planning to cover. So there's something else. That was it, I think, just. Yeah, so. I didn't bring something to connect this to. So I guess I have to make plots by hand. Okay, so let's start with synchrotron emission. So what is synchrotron emission? Anybody?
Relativistic emission in a magnetic field of an electron.
Magnetic field of an electron?
No.
Okay. So you had the right right words, but in different wrong order.
Yeah. So it's an electron in a magnetic field moving relativistically.
Good. Yes. If you have an electron, if you have a magnetic field and you have an electron that's moving in it, a spiral, or it could be any other charged particle. So if it's relativistic, or if it's not relativistic, it's going to emit some radiation because of the magic formula, which was what? What's the magic formula?
Two-thirds?
Q squared A squared over C cubed. So if something is in a magnetic field and it's moving, it experiences the force. That means there would be an acceleration. An acceleration means that there would be radiation. So this guy would emit light. So this is the electron. This is light that's coming out. I guess it could go in different directions. Now, so as you know, in the regime that this is non-relativistic, it's called cyclotron emission, and there is a cyclotron frequency associated with this rotation. It turns out that if you have relativistic emission, and this is much more significant, I mean, in principle, non-relativistic electrons have this cyclotron emission, but the amount of energy that's released is much more significant from relativistic electrons, and that's what's typically observed. So we're going to talk about that. Of course, what we do, we could just take the limit of velocity going to basically less than the speed of light, or gamma and relativistic Lorentz vector going to 1, and you recover the cyclotron results. But it's most interesting for ultra-relativistic electrons. And of course, by ultra-relativistic, we mean if gamma and Lorentz vector is much bigger than 1, or velocity is very close to the speed of light. So what is acceleration? So the standard formula is, of course, F equals ma. In CGS units, force is, so there's the velocity has two components. There is the velocity along the magnetic field, And there's a velocity perpendicular to the magnetic field, right? These are perpendicular to each other. They sum to make the total velocity. Something that's relativistic, of course, the total velocity is of order of speed of light. It's exactly very close to the speed of light. But in these components of the velocity would be less than the speed of light by the cosine of that pitch angle. So force is, as you know, is V cross P, which depends on the velocity perpendicular to magnetic field. And is equal to ma, but of course it's something that's relativistic, its mass is larger by the Lorentz factor. Gamma, and then acceleration, which is an acceleration. Of course, we know that something is moving in a circle, the acceleration is v squared over radius, right? So this is, I can call this rb. So this would be the Larmor radius. And remember, we discussed if you can calculate this, and this is all for essentially for most charged particles, this is tiny compared to the astrophysical situations. So in most astrophysical situations, except for like the most energetic cosmic rays, these electrons essentially follow magnetic field lines for intents and purposes. So this gives you a radius. This you can or a frequency. So this would be the cyclotron frequency, which is V, the perpendicular velocity divided by R, which is Q B divided by M gamma C, or Q B C divided by the energy, total energy. So this M gamma C is the total energy or mass of the particle. And so you can, if you want to put a number to this, this is 18 megahertz. Is gamma to the minus 1, and then it's B over 1 Gauss. So the larger the magnetic field, the larger it is, and it doesn't depend on, these are for electrons. This is for electron particles. Because that would be the highest, as a charged particle, this would be a smaller frequency. Okay. Let's see. Now, if you're talking about the relativistic particle, so remember, this was a non-relativistic formula. We didn't derive this, but you can derive this easily by one way to derive this, you can say, look at this textbook and other standard elementary electromagnetism textbooks, is by looking at emission from slowly moving particles, or even a simple way of deriving this relationship would be if you just take a charged particle which is at rest, and then it starts moving with some velocity. If you just take the electric field lines, this is after motion and then before motion. So let's say before motion, you have some radial electric field lines. And then after motion, it needs to be boosted by the velocity. So it would be something that looks a little bit asymmetric. And then if you try to match this to each other, there would be a zone that's this would be tilted. I'm not doing this very well. And anyway, in this zone, you can calculate the pointing flux in that zone, and that turns out to be this. So that's a calculation. If you haven't done it, it's worth doing. It's simpler than a standard derivation, but in either case, they all give you the same result. The important thing is that these are non-relativistic calculations. So in order to actually apply this for a relativistic electron, what you need to do to go to the rest frame of the instantaneous rest frame of the electron, where it's moving slowly or just starting to speed up in that rest frame, and then apply this formula. Because this formula is valid as long as the velocity is small, non-relativistic. So in order to apply it, you have to go through that frame and then calculate how much energy is emitted. So to do that, you have to boost. So what happens is, of course, you have to boost or Lorentz transform your electric and magnetic field. And the way to do it properly, so I'm not going to do too many things properly here. But this one, I thought is something that's worth doing because might be will come in handy. So the way you do it is that you go look at the field tensor. The field tensor is F mu nu, which is, I guess, D mu A nu minus D nu A mu. It's an anti-symmetric tensor in a special relativity or general relativity, if you want, it's whose components are electric and magnetic fields. So there is, it has zero sitting on the diagonal. It has EX, EY, EZ, and I might be missing signs here. That's it here. In the zero I components, so electric field is F zero I. And then the magnetic field is an IJ component. So this would be BZ, this would be BY, and this would be BX, and then the minus of that would be here, minus BY minus BX. Now I know this is kind of messy. I'm guessing you've already seen this. So the magnetic field is so Fij is epsilon, or if I want to write it, Bi is epsilon ijk fjk. There might be a 1/2 somewhere. I think there's a 1/2. And the sign I don't remember very well. So so this is a proper tensor. So the way it transforms under Lorentz transformation is basically like a product of two four vectors. And you basically all you do is you multiply this thing by a Lorentz boost. So remember Lorentz boost, how it worked. So this is a four vector. I'm okay, so I guess I'm going to miss C's here, speeds of light, because I cannot remember or keep track of them. So this is how, I mean, Lorentz transformation works in special relativity. If you just boost in one direction, you can and this is for a vector. So you can show this or represent it with a tensor. X prime mu is lambda mu nu times x mu, or x nu, sorry. Where lambda is just gamma. So I guess the way I did it with plus. But I mean, of course, this is all it has to do whether, I mean, you're moving, which direction you're moving. So yeah, I've done this with plus. You could do it with minus. It doesn't make any difference. Just the direction of the velocity that changes. And it's zero everywhere else. Okay. So now, since F mu nu is not a vector but rather a tensor, you have to act with two of these lambdas on it. So F tilde. Let's say alpha beta under, or F prime alpha beta, I can call it, should be lambda alpha mu lambda beta nu times F mu nu. This could be upstairs or downstairs, I guess. For those of you who care, I mean, it just changes things by minus signs. Yeah. So the way I should do it is I just take this matrix and multiply it by lambdas on two sides. And if in this case, I'm interested in a space with magnetic field, but no electric field. And this is something to have in mind that usually in the magnetic field is something, let's see. So what's the easy way to explain it? So it's much easier to have significant magnetic field than it is to have significant electric field. And the reason for that is the conductivity is very large in most astrophysical situations. So so you know if you have electric fields, it actually moves charges and induce currents. That those currents, they if there is some conductivity, that's going to happen, and that's going to neutralize the electric field. And it turns out that if you calculate the conductivity in most astrophysical situations, because the density is so low, the conductivity is very high, so electric field basically decays instantly. The same way that's in a metal, you cannot have an electric field. So that's why in most astrophysical situations, you have a negligible electric field unless there is something active, like solar flares, that's one, something that's very dynamical that's happening, where magnetic field, where everything is changing very fast, you could have significant electric field. But in most cases, the electric field is very small, and the reason for that is conductivity is big. So in the rest frame of the plasma, you have just magnetic field and no electric field. And so then this tensor would be just, so what I have to do is basically multiply this lambda by something that just has magnetic field. And I'm going to keep, for some reason, I have BZ here. Well, I guess that's good as any other component. So what I'm doing is I'm just multiplying this lambda. I have written in advance, so I don't have to write it again. So, so there's a B and minus B in the Z direction, and everything else is zero. And then multiply it by this guy again, gamma V, gamma V, gamma. 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. Okay, so if I do this, then this basically, if you do this matrix multiplication, so this is now what I've written here is lambda times F times lambda, which is what I want to do there. And that gives me the new field tensor, which, so F prime as a matrix, which tells me what is the electric and magnetic field. So it's gamma VB, 0, gamma B, 0, plus minus gamma VB, minus gamma B, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay. So here now, there's a magnetic field and there's an electric field. Electric field is in what direction?
Y.
Good. This is X, Y, Z. And how much is it?
Gamma VB.
Good. So there's an electric field which is in the Y direction is gamma VB, and there's a magnetic field. This is now different, is gamma B. So this is how electric field boosts. If you're so here I'm assuming that magnetic field is in the Y direction and the boost is in the X direction, right? So there was a magnetic field in the Y direction, let's say this is Y, and the boost was in the X direction. So that's where the electron is moving. Right, V electron. So this would look more complicated. So that would be assuming that there is zero pitch angle, or I guess 90 degrees pitch angle. It's just electrons going around like this. If it has both components, then it's going to look more complicated. But you're going to get, this is the simplest way you can get synchrotron emission. So, so there is an electric field. So the acceleration would be okay, so in the rest frame of the particle, so the Lorentz force, So this is the, this was of course F prime mu. The Lorentz force is Q times E plus V cross B divided by C. But in a instantaneous stress from the particle, there is no velocity. So the only thing that matters to calculate acceleration is the electric field, right? And right. So acceleration A prime would be this divided by the mass, which would be Q gamma V perpendicular V divided by the mass. Right? And then there is, so why do I have C here? Oh, okay. So if I didn't put C's here because there were, I had to put too many C's. But really, you can, wherever there is V, there is in fact V over C, just to get the dimensions right. If you kept the C's, you would see that there would be a C down here. And right, so this is just, and I guess you have to remember that, so this has the same dimension as this, V over C cross B, same dimension as E. E and B in CGS units have the same units. So this is just charge times field, and then everything else here is dimensionless. OK, so now I can calculate use the magic formula in this frame, dE prime by dT prime. But what's amazing is that this energy loss rate, the rate of energy loss, is in fact independent of the frame. And the reason for that is that both of these guys transform in the same way under Lorentz symmetry. So the way to see this is, basically what I want to say is that these two are the same. dE by dt is the same as dE prime by dt prime. And the reason for that is that basically under Lorentz symmetry, E is, E is gamma E prime minus V times P. And I guess there's the 1 over C here. Well, I can't remember all the C's, so let's just set C equal to 1 here. And then T is gamma T prime minus V dot X. But then in the instantaneous rest frame, right, so let's see, am I doing that? Okay, there's a prime here. And right, so in the instantaneous rest frame, so this prime frame, the momentum of the electron is 0, so this is 0. And if it sits at the origin, this is also 0. So these two are proportional. So E by T or dE by dt, I can do this with dt and dE as well. dE by dt is the dE prime by dt prime. So both of them, both dE or dp mu, look, I guess another way to put it is that dp mu, the change in the four momentum, and dx mu, the change in the four position, they are both four vectors. So they transform in the same way. So this ratio is the same. It's a little bit subtle, but if you think about it, it's correct. So I'm interested in dE by dt, but I can calculate dE prime by dt prime, which I already have a formula for, because in the rest frame, instantaneous rest frame of an electron, this formula works, so I can just plug that in. Sorry. It's 2/3 and Q squared over C cubed times the square of this, which is Q squared, gamma squared, V squared, over M squared, C squared, and I guess there's V squared. So, right. So I get something that looks like do I have everything here? I get 2 times V squared over 8 pi. And then you should remember the definition of Thompson cross-section, but it turns out that if you use that, so you have a Q to the fourth power ms squared, this is for electron, the denominator and the right powers of C. you just get sigma t here, the Thompson cross section, times gamma square times your perpendicular square divided by c. So this, remember, this combination is just the energy density of magnetic field. So this is something I mentioned before, I think, at some point, that the rate of, so what we conclude here is that the rate of energy emission is basically the rate at which, you can think of it as the rate at which a cross-section sigma t is swooping up the magnetic energy. So that's true up to this factor of gamma. And I guess, so there's the factor of gamma and then the this thing, and then this V guy is just the rate, right? So the flux of energy, magnetic energy, if you're moving with velocity V, the flux of magnetic energy would be UB, the energy density, times the velocity. And if you multiply by cross section, that's the rate at which you're swooping up energy. And then these are some relativistic factors that have to be included. Does this make sense? So this is one way to think about synchrotron emission. Or it works just on dimensional grounds, but then you cannot, that doesn't tell you what the dimensionless factors are doing. But I guess our calculation, the exact calculation that we did here does that. So the other thing is this guy is two-thirds of two-thirds average of velocity squared. Right. Am I missing something up? Hopefully not. Right. So, I mean, here I was assuming that there was no velocity along the magnetic field lines. I guess implicitly here I'm assuming that that doesn't make much of a difference, which at some level it makes sense because moving along the magnetic field doesn't lead to radiation. But then, yeah, so whether there are higher order effects, I'm not showing that, but you can try to verify it yourself that there is no crosstalk that's not already included here between parallel or perpendicular velocities. So here what we need is V perpendicular squared, and if you assume isotropic distribution of electrons, then there would be the same V squared in every direction would be the same on average. So this guy is two-thirds of the total V squared because only two of the components, two of the directions contribute to the perpendicular squared. All three directions would contribute to this. So that would be easy and to include that. And let's see whether something else I need to put in. So that would be just, that would give you another factor of two-thirds that you could plug in there. So if I can, if I plug in the numbers, you want to figure out basically how long it takes for an electron to lose all its energy by emitting synchrotron emission. So the time scale T synchrotron would be roughly E divided by E dot. Right. Of course, it cannot radiate its rest energy, but here we're talking about relativistic electrons. So most of energy is the kinetic energy. So this is gamma mc squared divided by E dot, which we've calculated here. So if you plug in the numbers, you get something that's of order 10 to the 10 years for the magnetic field of a microgauss, which is a typical, or 10 to the minus 6 gauss, which is a typical magnetic field of the galaxy, and energy of a GeV. Of course, this is a relativistic electron because the rest mass of an electron is how much? Half an MeV. So this would be a gamma, would be, what would be gamma for a GeV electron? Anybody? What is the gamma of a GeV electron? It has to do with the rest mass and GeV, and it is What is it? Ansu, do you want to go ahead?
Is it sort of
relation dimension? So it's like 1,000? Good. So it's maybe 2,000, right? For GeV divided by half an MeV, it would be 2,000, right? Because we saw here, or I guess we had a formula somewhere here, where M gamma is the total energy, right? The rest mass times gamma is the total energy. I guess I had it in some places. I don't see it right now, but that's, I mean, I guess kind of I did that here. The total energy is M times gamma. Okay, so what does this tell us? So it's interesting. It tells us that if you want to have electrons that you cannot keep electrons around that are more energetic than GeV because they would lose energy within a Hubble time. Because 10 to the 10 years, remember, that's the age of the universe or age of the galaxy. So the only way to have electrons that are more energetic than a GeV is to constantly replenish them. Right? You need to constantly accelerate them or generate them at higher energies. Otherwise, they would lose their energy to basically synchrotron emission. So that's why it's interesting that so there were these experiments a while back. And I think I was trying to dig up a reference, but I didn't have time to do it. At least they've been kind of continuously updated. Let me see. Right, I guess I can write here. So they basically look at the positron to electron ratio. Or positron fraction, let's say. So this is the number of electron positrons that you detect on satellites on Earth, divided by this number of electrons plus positrons. And then what you see is that, you see, this is something that drops rapidly. And here, this is just the fraction. And down here is just the energy. And then what you observe, and these are just observations, that at some point you see that, I mean, there are some data points that show that this turn up. And this, where this turn up happens is somewhere around 10 GeV or so. This is around 10 GeV. 10 GeV is the 100 GeV. I guess this is the 1 GeV, let's say. 1 GeV is here. So the prediction is that this thing should go down because of the cooling. So you continuously, whatever you produce, it's going to be cool. So you're not going to have the stuff that are here. If you produce, of course, this is not showing you the total amount. This is just showing that positron to electron plus positron fraction. So it's a little bit non-trivial to convert this to the total number. But nevertheless, what it's showing is that right, so you have this excess of positrons at high enough at high energies, while I mean if you they cannot be staying there for long because they would be losing all their energy. It's by synchrotron emission. This is not the right plot. I guess now I think about it, maybe this is not the best thing. You could also show the total number of electron plus positron. You have to go to higher energies, but that also shows that it's actually there's an uptake. So at around the TeV or so. And these are experiments, because there's AMS2, the PAMELA. These are different experiments, Fermi. And basically, these are satellites that measure just electrons and positrons that are coming into the, get close to the Earth orbit. So.
Is there an increase because of power production?
It's not quite clear why there is an increase, but basically the idea is there must be some way of making them quickly, basically, right? So the current idea is either dark matter, dark matter annihilation. So this is why it was very interesting for a while, or because people got excited about it. It still could be true. So that dark matter actually goes to electrons and positrons. And that's why this ratio also increases, because dark matter is equally likely to go to electron and positron. I mean, dark matter is neutral, so it should, if it goes to electrons, then it should also produce positron. The other possibility is if it comes from pulsars, which are basically magnetized neutron stars. which have very high magnetic fields and fast rotations. And it's not, of course, this would be more exotic and more exciting, but the problem with pulsars is that, I mean, we know they are there and we don't understand their physics very well. So it seems that it's also possible that it would be coming from pulsars. We couldn't tell based on the direction whether they're coming from pulsars or not, because, can anybody tell? No, some of them have angular resolution. Anybody say guess why, based on direction, we cannot say it's coming from pulsars? Something I already mentioned. Because of?
Along the jets.
Along the jets. If they come out of jets, that jet, and if come gets to us, we should be able to see it coming from the pulsar, right? So that doesn't say that why we wouldn't see. I mean, we should see that coming from.
Should get deflected at some point.
Deflected by what? By. These are electron positrons, right?
That we mentioned.
Right, right.
By photons.
By photons. Well, some sort of photons, but not Thompson or Compton. It's just
because isn't the light emitted?
We're not talking about light. We're talking about actual electron and positrons, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, I guess I don't know. Maybe it was too obvious. It's because of the magnetic field, right? So if these guys are following magnetic fields, even if they came from pulsars, they kind of been following some tangled magnetic field. So we wouldn't be coming from the direction of a pulsar, right? Because particles don't follow straight lines. Charged particles don't follow straight lines. They follow magnetic field. In fact, it's this calculation, this measurement here, it's very uncertain, because at these energies, the Larmor radius is smaller than the size of the solar system. So depending on the solar activity, level of solar activity, the observations here could actually vary quite a bit. Because if the magnetic field of the sun, which is responsible for the solar wind, if it's higher or lower, then fewer, more electrons and positrons can get to us here. But then at these higher energies, the Larmor radius becomes bigger than the size of the solar system. But still, I mean, solar system is much smaller than the galaxy. So it's smaller than the size of the galaxy. So you wouldn't, even if these guys come from pulsars, you wouldn't be able to tell. Right. So that's interesting. Okay, so this is the total energy that's, sorry, I should always remember to turn this off, but I guess I don't. So, can I turn this off? No, come on. Okay, so this is the total energy that's emitted, and the interesting number to have in mind is, I mean, this synchrotron emission, because this is, so this tells you how energetic a particle you can have in a galaxy. For protons, of course, they are more energetic, so this limit would be higher because of this 1/ms². So because of 1/ms². On the other hand, in regions that the magnetic field is bigger, then you have this is more efficient. It goes as magnetic field is squared, as you see. So the cutoff can go down. Or in other words, if you see energetic cosmic rays or electrons at high enough energies, there must be an active way of accelerating to those energies or generating them at those energies. Okay, so the other thing we're going to discuss, and I'm going to discuss this not in too much detail because it's going to take too much time, or it's too much detail, is the spectrum of a spectrum of synchrotron radiation. So I guess I can now push this up, bring this down. Right. And but if you're interested to see the details, if you haven't already seen it, this would be in the standard electrodynamics textbooks or in this book if you're interested, where basically you calculate the exact spectrum for a relativistic electron going around the magnetic field line. So the basics is that if you have a relativistic electron, then emission from this would be beamed. So it's called relativistic beaming. And of course, this is generally true for anything that emits relativistically. If it emits isotropically in the rest frame or in the rest frame of the object, then after the relativistic beaming, there's an angle. If it's moving in this direction, the radiation would come in a cone, come out in a cone. And the opening of the cone theta would be of order 1 over gamma. So for GeV electrons, it would be thousandth of a radian. And right, so this would be MCS squared over E. And let's see what else. So the significance of this then is if you're looking at this guy, this cone, is that if you're looking at this guy, most of the time you're not seeing the radiation. Because it's coming in this narrow cone. This is kind of actually how pulsar looks like. That there isn't, sometimes you see some pulsar, most of the time you don't see, is that the emission is beamed. So it needs to be actually pointing in you. And of course, if this is going around the magnetic field line, it may be that it never points at you. This cone is kind of precessing, and this theta is a small. So often, for a random observer, it may never point at you. Well, I guess let's see. I guess it typically, I mean, I think there is an order, I don't know, tens of percent probability that it would cross your line of sight, I believe, yeah. But the important thing is that it only does it a small fraction of a time. So if you're interested in measuring the electric field, let's say electric field, due to this emission where you're sitting, so you have a radio telescope, for example, that's measuring this. If it was a non-relativistic particle, it would be just some sinusoidal, because this is just a harmonic oscillation. Everything is just moving with like cosine of omega t. This would have been cyclotron emission. This is observed electric field, say your radio telescope. But then because of this beaming effect, you actually see it only when it crosses line of sight. So it would be something like this. Actually, only one direction. It's not two-sided. And I believe it doesn't have to be at the maximum. It could be anywhere, any other point. Let me just put it here. And of course, this is the faster or the more relativistic it is, the narrower is this cone. So the narrower is this pulsed emission. So that's how the emission would look like. And let's see what else. So this is the observed, the duration of this, call it the observation time. And the important thing is that this is much shorter than the frequency for a relativistic particle. The frequency, the cyclotron frequency, is just the rate at which the frequency at which it goes around the magnetic field line. But so that would be this would be like 2 pi over omega c. But then the actual pulse that you see would be during a much shorter time scale. That implies that the actual frequency that you see would be much higher, right? And so the formulas that I'm not going to derive, and I'm a bit confused by, might have a typo, so that's why I brought this here. So theta, I didn't write theta. Theta is just 1 over gamma. Because of that, I have it correctly. T observed is T observed is theta divided by omega times 1 minus V over C. So theta over 1 divided by 1 omega, divided by omega, that makes sense, right? Because, so because you're basically, it has to cross your line of sight, and this angle is small, this T observed would be shorter by basically a factor of theta divided by 2 pi, roughly. I'm not writing the 2 pi's here. But so this one is a relativistic factor. I don't remember how this is derived, this 1 minus V over C. So this guy is, you can relate this to gamma again. So we know gamma is 1 over square root of 1 minus V over C squared, which is 1 over square root of minus V over C times 2, roughly. Right, because it's 1 minus V over C times 1 plus V over C. If V is almost C, then this is 2. So so this says that 1 over 1 minus V over C is roughly up to these factors over 2. It's just 1 over gamma squared. Right. So right. Okay. So this is theta over omega gamma squared. Do I have this correctly? Theta 1 over omega is correct. And then theta 1 over gamma squared. Well, I guess this is seems to be the right formula as far as I can tell. R over theta. Yeah, this looks a little different from what I have down here. But then this would be just 1 over gamma cubed, I guess omega inverse divided by gamma cubed, because theta was 1 over gamma. Okay, so I'm thinking I'm missing something here. But V over RB, theta is 1 over gamma. Am I making a mistake? 1 over gamma squared. So this is omega C. This is cyclotron frequency. So what I got here is gamma squared instead of gamma cubed. And I'm not 100% sure whether I'm screwing something up. Right. Theta divided by omega. Oh, okay. I think I see I'm missing something. Yeah. Well, anyway, so I'm misquoting this. This is just right. So this I think I'm copying the equations incorrectly. What this is I think I have it correctly here. This just turns out at the end of the day to be just theta. Just theta is somehow included in this 1 minus v over c. So, sorry, 1 minus v over c. So, I think at the end of the day, they're just gamma squared here. So, I'm trying to remember how it worked, but yeah. So there is a gamma squared factor. So I have to remind myself how this was done. But yeah, so I think there was something there. The notes, there's a typo in it. That's why I'm a bit confused. I think I made a mistake in the notes. So T observe is just 1 over omega times 1 minus v over c. This is not quite. So if it was just the angle effect, it would be 1 over gamma. But then there is another relativistic effect that give you another gamma factor. And I can think about it and remember how this was done. I don't remember it right now. But this turns out to be gamma squared. And then omega of emission, synchrotron, is roughly basically 1 over this time scale. 1 over t observed, which goes as gamma squared times omega c. So that's the important distinction. And the synchrotron frequency doesn't depend on energy. Or actually, I see what I did. No, OK. I was right. I didn't screw anything up. There was theta here, theta here. And this was 1 over omega c gamma cubed. But then if I want to express this in terms of write down how omega depends on gamma, which is 1 over t observed, it's gamma cubed times omega c. But omega c has a 1 over gamma in it, right? Because the more energetic a particle is, you see it up there, because of the Lorentz Lorentz factor there, it's more energetic. So its frequencies are smaller. So if you multiply this, you get a gamma squared, which is what I had. So the exact formula is omega synchrotron. It's basically this formula, but with the 2 pi's and all the, well, 3 halves and such. It's 3 halves q b sine alpha divided by mc times gamma squared. So this alpha is the pitch angle. I mean, you can guess what this is. If it's 0, then I mean, it's just moving along the direction of magnetic field. So there is no frequent synchrotron emission. If it's 90 degrees, then it's just going around magnetic field. So there is no velocity component along the direction of magnetic field. So that's the formula. And then this is roughly 10 to the 2 megahertz for a microgauss magnetic field. And then it goes as E squared G. Right. So this actually increases as you go to higher frequencies, right? Or higher energies. And this is what I was talking about, is that even though there are many more electrons that are less energetic, are non-relativistic, the ones that actually emit synchrotron emission or cyclotron or synchrotron, most of the energy comes from the most energetic ones. And this is something, for example, because Natasha, we were talking about this, the contaminations for cosmic microwave background. At low frequencies, this is the most significant contamination of cosmic microwave background. And I mean, all radio galaxies, this is the primary emission mechanism for radio galaxies. Essentially, most of what radios that we see in the sky comes from synchrotron. And this has to do with relativistic electrons. Okay? It's kind of interesting that, I mean, of course, they cannot be very relativistic because then they would emit so fast that they would lose all their energy. So the energy would be somewhere around GeV. If it's much less than that, then they don't emit too much. If it's more than that, then they're gonna, with more than, if it's let, then if more than that, then they're going to lose energy so fast that we're not going to be seeing them. Okay, so that's the characteristic frequency for omega sync. Let's call it omega s just so that it's easier. And I can calculate also as I said, I'm not calculating the exact spectrum. It's going to be, if you look at the standard textbooks, this is what it turns out to be. It has a peak at that scale, omega s, and it's exactly looks like this. This is a classical calculation at this point. So I'm going to tell you what quantum effects will do to it. 2 pi mc squared and some function of omega divided by omega s. So this f guy is some special function, f of psi, cos psi, integral to psi, infinity, you know, k 5/3. It doesn't matter, but it is something I guess you can plug into Mathematica. This is the Bessel function, or some Bessel function. And so this is the spectrum, right? This is averaged over all angles, though, which is, I guess, what usually matters. If you have a tangled magnetic field, then you don't actually see the polarization. If you don't have a tangled magnetic field, if you have the ordered magnetic field, then the emission will be polarized. So that's the primary way of getting polarization of electromagnetic field. Because if you have electric field or magnetic field in one direction, things are going this direction, going around in this direction. So there will be dipole variation in that direction. That would be the direction of polarization. Polarization will be perpendicular to the magnetic field line. And in fact, that's like, for example, by observations of synchrotron emission from our galaxy, we can map the magnetic field geometry of our galaxy. Right. So let's see, I have 10 minutes. So the total power, so this is for a fixed, for a given energy of electron. But then if you have a spectrum of electrons, of all energies, like if the number density of electrons, the E goes as E is proportional to the electron to the power of minus P dE, then you can integrate over all electrons, and that gives you the total power as a function of omega that goes as omega to the power of minus S, P to the power of 1 plus s, where s is, where p is 2s plus 1. So basically, this is how you get the power law. I mean, this is not a power law. This has a peak. This f guy, this is how the way it looks like is it's some power law at the small frequencies, and then it peaks at omega s.
Is that
omega
to the minus s or minus?
Omega to the power of minus s, assuming that I haven't made a mistake. And you can also calculate the alpha. This is emission, absorption of synchrotron. So if the magnetic field is large enough or at low enough frequencies, in fact, a synchrotron emission that you can actually, using the arguments we had before, can relate emission to absorption. And that goes as nu or omega. This could be omega. The power of minus 1/2 p plus 4. So at low enough frequencies, the synchrotron, synchrotron cannot even get out, because the same process that causes it to emit, it also causes it to be absorbed. So it becomes thick to synchrotron, optically thick to synchrotron emission. Okay, so that's everything you need to know about synchrotron emission. Any questions? Yes.
About the calculation, the different frames.
Right.
So we move to a frame at which instantaneously
at rest. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we compute the acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
So that big perpendicular is.
Right. So this is the total magnetic field. The V, you mean V per, sorry, you said the V perpendicular, right? So this is V perpendicular to magnetic field, right? And so, right, so I mean here in this calculation I've done here, I assume oh, there is only V perpendicular, I assume there is no V parallel. I think the calculation, it goes through the same way, but I'm not 100% sure. So it's something that one can do. I don't remember. I mean, I think this is a simpler one. I assume there is just V perpendicular in those calculations, but I think it doesn't make a difference. The same result comes true. I mean, there might be factors order one difference. Okay, good. But yeah, in that Wood-Lorentz bus, I assume there is only V perpendicular. There was no V parallel in that calculation. Right.
So, but that's the loss of energy in that specific frame.
Right. And I was arguing the same.
Yeah, so we argue that we can use that formula because in that frame, it's continuously.
Is at rest.
It's at rest. But eventually, in that same frame.
Right, but we don't care about eventually. We just at that very moment, this is the rate at loss of energy. And then I argue that this rate is something that Lorentz invariant.
I see.
Right. It's a. Right. It's this rate is something as Lorentz invariant. It's and I guess another way, there's another way of seeing this is.
My issue is that in that frame, eventually the thing won't be moving slowly.
Right. Absolutely.
So that thing will break.
Yeah,
down.
That's right. That thing would break down. Right. Okay. But then I'm saying that the result should still be valid, even though the derivation is not, because I can still do this calculation and go to a different frame, which is an instantaneous rest. And right. But I mean, this calculation, I mean, it's only strictly valid when at the instantaneous rest frame of the electron, but then that's the only point we apply it. Right? Okay. Good, good questions. Let's see whether something else that's left. All right, so this is very important, the synchrotron emission. And yes.
I guess back to that. So instead of using this derivation, could you relate it somehow to like the Poynting flux or something?
Right. Okay. So if you want to do this properly, then I mean it's not actually that hard. What you have to do is you basically have to integrate. So there are this I forgot the name of them. But basically there's this standard equations for how the potential, the vector potential for a moving charge looks like, which is basically, essentially looks like the Coulomb law, right? But then I think but the tricky thing is that you have to do it in the past light cone. So it's not instantaneous distance, it's instant distance at the past light cone. So you can write down the vector potential, but then the expression gets complicated if you want to convert from the light cone coordinates to the instantaneous coordinates. But then when you do that, then you can just calculate the Poynting flux and basically all the properties, right? And then you can find the details in the textbook, right? So that's how it's done. And I guess probably Jackson also has it. You all have to do electrodynamics, don't you? Okay. So I'm not sure if you get to do this because Jackson does have it, but it's a very big book. So I'm guessing probably most people don't get to do it. Okay, so I've got 10 more minutes. So the rest of the stuff I have is about line emission, but it's actually, I mean, now I look at it, it's the stuff I've already talked about at some level, because we did talk about, the oscillator, harmonic oscillator, and basically when we discussed Thomson scattering or Thomson absorption, Thomson scattering, we also discussed if this electron is tied to some harmonic oscillator, and I said that's a good model for an atom. If electron that's in the bounded state is bound to an atom, because that has natural frequency. So it's basically the details are the same, and so I already covered that. So I guess what I'm going to mention here, let's see. I've already used this one. We can pick this up, I suppose, now. Right. Okay. So I'm not going to write down the formula, but these are the standard ones that I think I've already written down all of these. So if you have a spectral line, so far these were four free electrons, right? For Riemann-Schrödinger is free, synchrotron is free. But of course, if you have bound particles, then there would be spectral lines, as we've discussed. And these are often very narrow spectral lines. And the narrowness, remember we discussed, has to do with non-relativistic particles. As long as you're talking about non-relativistic bound states, then they are going to be very narrow. And they're suppressed basically by powers of V over C, either two or three powers. So this is how they generically look like. It's or I guess it's defined as gamma divided by omega minus omega 1, 2 squared plus gamma squared over 4. And this gamma has a good name. I guess it's a transition rate. And this you can derive from a harmonic oscillator that we did last time. Remember we discussed this basically, if this is omega, one over gamma is the width of this. For like hydrogen atom, this is like gamma over omega 1, 2, which is this is the frequency of the transition, is something like 10 to the minus 7. And these are allowed transitions. As I said, this is a small because electrons are non-relativistic. So this is small by some powers of alpha, basically. So this is known as the so there are two things that I guess is worth discussing. The bound, the cross-section, the total cross-section, and this BB is bound, is something that's of order, I guess, this pi Q squared over MC F12. I guess this is actually by definition. This is the definition. F12 and phi of omega. The phi of omega is that function. So this is known as the Lorentz distribution. Lorentzian, I guess. This has this particular shape. And so one thing that could happen is that if you have collisions, it could actually, if you have a high enough density, let me see. Okay, and one more thing to mention is that this is the maximum of sigma, before talking about that, is the wavelength squared. So the typical cross section is just basically of order of a Thomson cross section. It can get much bigger here, but this, right, so this thing, remember, this was of order Thomson. This was just basically Thomson cross section, if I remember correctly. This F12, yeah. I think it's Thomson cross section divided by omega 1, 2. But no, actually, that cannot be omega 1, 2 here. I'm missing something. I think it's sigma t divided by gamma. Right? Yeah, OK. So this is sigma t divided by gamma. And this phi omega has this shape. And F12 is this oscillator strength, which is of order 1. But it could be much smaller than 1 for forbidden transitions. So the thing to have in mind is that basically this is something that's depends on its interaction strength. It's, as I said, it's something over the Thomson cross section, but could be much bigger in the middle by a factor of basically gamma over omega 1, 2. But the maximum that it can get, and this is something to do with basically properties of quantum mechanics, is the wavelength squared. So this guy could be very small. But then at the resonance, it could look very big. But the biggest it could look like is the square of the wavelength of the atom. So this width is called basically natural width of the line. Every line, just by the nature that it's emission or emitted or absorbed, it has a natural width. If it has zero natural width, you can never see it. It never emits, never absorbs. There is a collisional broadening. So the standard calculation assumes you have just one atom that's in isolation. But if atoms kind of keep hitting each other, then you can, it's just the Heisenberg isentropy principle, right? If that is the part, if you have a finite time to reach equilibrium, then frequencies can never be better determined than that time. So there is a delta omega. So this is a delta omega of order 1 over gamma, or of order gamma. I guess this is gamma, not gamma inverse. I'm confused. Yeah, I think this is gamma, right? Gamma is a small length. So this is delta omega, it would be like 1 over time for collisions. For low density regions, this is not a problem. I mean, most of astrophysics, this is the case. This is a tiny effect. But then in dense regions, this could be a big effect, because basically if the atoms keep hitting each other, that leads to another broadening. And then the last one, and I guess so that I'm going to finish with that, is a Doppler broadening. So Doppler broadening has to do with what? Particles moving around. Right, exactly. I guess it could have to do, well, I mean, cosmological velocities don't lead to broadening, they just lead to redshift, right? Because things are moving, right? So broadening is just saying that this line, we don't know exactly what it is, because this frequency is redshifted or blue shifted by the motion of the atoms. Now, the characteristic thing about Doppler broadening, which is in contrast to natural collision, is that it's not given by the Lorentzian. Both of these are actually given, it turns out, given by the Lorentzian distribution. This is something basically about quantum mechanical transitions that give you a Lorentzian distribution. The Doppler broadening is given by what? How does it look like?
Maxwellian,
exactly. So it's in fact a Gaussian. I mean, right, because you care about the line of sight velocity, which is in fact is Gaussian, because if you have a thermal distribution, this thing, the probability of velocity just goes as e to the minus v squared over 2 sigma squared, where sigma squared is just kT over m. So this would be the m of the mass of the atoms. I guess there's a 1/2 here. So this is just for thermal distribution, and this is in one direction, let's say vx. So if there's a velocity, then the v over c would be the redshift or the blue shift. So p of omega, this says p of omega would be basically proportional to exponential of omega minus omega bar squared divided by delta omega squared. And delta omega is just sigma squared over c squared. Or delta omega is sigma over c. So delta omega over omega naught, if I want to give a number, so we plug in from there, it's 4 times 10 to the minus 5 times the square root of t divided by 10 to the 4 Kelvin. And then this is mass divided by the mass of a hydrogen atom. So this could be actually significantly bigger than this guy. This is 10 to the minus 5. This is for, of course, this is for 10 to the 4, 10,000 Kelvin gas. But I mean, like I said, star, this is the typical temperature of the surface of a star, 6,000 Kelvin. So this could be much bigger than this, right? So this broadening, this delta omega. However, we might both of them can be detected. And can you guess how? You can actually see both of them in a spectrum of a star, both the natural broadening and collisional broadening. Good, exactly. So these are different profiles, right? So this is much narrower, but in fact, it drops as 1 over delta omega squared, right? So this one could be much broader, but it drops exponentially. So typically, the way these things look like then is you have, now I want to make a good plot of this. So basically, you have this very narrow thing, but then you convolve that with a broad thing. So the way it looks like is phi omega versus omega. You have, I guess I can do the log of this versus log of delta omega, omega minus omega bar. So there is a Gaussian, right? This is Gaussian would be just a parabola, but then there would be, it becomes a line. So it would be a Gaussian, but then there is a line depending on the ratio of these that would come out. And this has the slope of -2, right? Because it's 1 over omega delta omega squared. So in principle, if you have a good enough measurement of lines, then in the center of the line, at least for hot enough regions, you see the Gaussian, which is just due to Doppler broadening. But as you go to the outskirts of the line, if you can actually measure outskirts, then the Gaussian goes to zero exponentially, but then you see these tails, the Lorentzian tails of the spectrum. And so I guess there is something called curve of growth that relates basically this to the properties of the medium. I'm going to talk about that on Thursday. But this is something interesting. The main point to take home from this is that there are different reasons that the lines aren't as narrow as they could be. They're not delta functions. And they tell us something, basically. They could tell us about the natural property of the line. They could tell us about the density of the region. They could lead to collisional broadening. And they certainly, that very important, useful thing in astrophysics, they could tell us about the temperature of the region that's emitting or absorbing the line. Right. Okay, any questions? Not? Thank you. And I guess I see you on Thursday. Same place.
Are we meeting in a different room on Friday?
We're going to meet in a space room this Friday. Right. Was it?
Yeah, I think there was an email that said.
Okay.
Soon.
I think it's like, I think the first two times was the same room, and then the rest of them, there would be was in another one. Okay, I have to. Well, I mean, I forward you the same emails I got. I think what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna just invite you to some calendar event, so I have all the right rooms in them. But yeah, well, check your emails, and I'm gonna show up. The right room, hopefully.
What's the pronunciation?
I call it Stanyaev Zeldovich.
Stanyaev.
Yeah.
Tomorrow I need to talk about that.
What is that?